You're listening to JS Party, the award-winning weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web.
Who likes good news, everyone?
Our new weekly podcast plus email newsletter covers all the developer news that's worth your attention. We keep it brief, entertaining, and always on point. Check out Changelog News at changelog.com/news.
I'm not hearing a no.
Thanks to our partners at Fastly for shipping JS Party all around the world to wherever you listen. And to fly.io, host your app close to your users, no ops required. Okay, hey, it's party time, y'all. World, it is your internet friend. I'm Jared, and I am joined today by Amelia. What's going on?
Hey, I'm so excited about our episode today.
I am as well. I've never felt more out of my league or out of my depth than when I'm with like a digital / real world artist. We're joined today by Alex Miller, aka Space Filler. What's up, Alex?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Appreciate you joining us. So I came across your work, as one does, on the internet by following a link from somebody else in some other place. And I landed on Grid World, and I immediately thought, we got to get this guy on JS Party because this is so cool. And let's talk about it. But before we start there, in reading this Grid World piece, which is kind of a, what's the word? Not literature, an essay. It's a...
Yeah, I think I'd call it an essay.
It's an essay / art hybrid, which kind of is one of the things that you do. And in it, you write about your dad. And one thing that you say about your dad is that he and his brother created a computer game called Myst. And then you said that nobody under the age of 30 knows what Myst is. And if you can tell by my gray hairs over here, I am not under 30. I know Myst. I freaking loved Myst in the 90s. And I feel cooler just by the transitive property of mathematics. I don't know. I just by knowing you, whose dad created Myst. That is so rad, dude.
It's really cool. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously it's hard for me to have perspective on it.
Yeah.
Being his son, but that is like the reaction that a lot of people over 30 have to it. I think it touched a lot of people.
So Amelia, as we date ourselves here, Myst, know it or not?
Oh yeah. This is actually something I played with my dad.
Oh, cool.
When me and my sister were kids, we'd sit on his lap and he'd play Myst. And one, it was terrifying. A lot of trauma associated with
right. The
world of Myst. And two, we never finished it.
Oh, it was hard.
It was long. It was hard. It was spooky, but also very cool.
Yeah. There were moments of spookiness. There were also moments of just like awe, as it was just this beautiful world. It's kind of first person puzzler. Alex, how do you describe Myst to those who haven't played the game?
It's like a point and click puzzle adventure. Yeah, it has kind of like an atmosphere to it that I think some would describe as spooky, but it's just a very specific atmosphere.
Yeah,
that I think a lot of folks related to.
Yeah, it kind of, you drop into this world and you're just like left. There's like very little explanation or tutorial, and you're just kind of like, well, here we are in a room or on an island. I can't remember the first part. And just like start clicking on stuff and seeing what happens. And I think prior to Myst, the only PC game or computer game that I'd played, I was always an NES guy, was like King's Quest IV or something, which was very much in the world of animation. And, you know, this felt as a young person in the 90s like a real new world. Like it didn't feel drawn. It felt almost like you were just there. Of course, it was pixelated to a certain extent. Like nowadays, the graphics probably wouldn't hold up as realistic. But back then as a kid, I was like, this is a whole new world.
I'm curious, did you get like sneak peeks of the game or did you have to play it?
So for Myst, that was kind of, I forget the timeline exactly, but I was born in 91 and I think did Myst come out in right around then. So maybe it was 93 or something. So I was still a wee babe.
Right.
But I do have like a very specific memory of my dad like showing it to me. And he and his brother made other games as well that were more targeted towards kids.
Okay.
So I actually have much stronger memories of playing those earlier games that never became as popular, but those really made an impact on young Alex.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So when did you realize that Myst was like beyond something that your dad made or like something that that other people liked. I mean, in the piece you write about how you came across it at this museum, and there was this section about Myst at a museum, and it was a very big deal because it was kind of groundbreaking in certain ways. And I wasn't even a PC gamer kid, but it was like I heard about Myst and had to go and play it. And so when it, you know, you were maybe 1 year old, 2 year old at the time, when did you realize that Myst at this time in the 90s was like this big deal that your dad made?
It's really interesting because you know like I'm sure if I would have been older it would have been more obvious to me, but I don't think I quite understood it until I was, you know, maybe in my like 20s or so. And then when I'm talking with my friends, like a lot of them don't necessarily know what it is, right? Because when it came out, they were also 1 and 2.
Right.
So it was more of like their parents would know about it, right? and so, yeah, it's kind of tricky because it like, I don't think I ever quite understood the impact until it was already kind of a little bit over.
Right.
And not to say that, you know, folks have continued to like enjoy it and there's still a certain amount of fandom about it. But I think it's true that like a lot of younger folks, you know, the video game industry moves really, really quickly.
Right. And
it was quickly eclipsed by things that came after it. There was one moment I remember, I think I was in elementary school and I checked out from the school library, Guinness Book of World Records, and Myst was in that book. Like there was like a little blurb about it.
Wow.
And that I think was kind of like, that was the moment that I was like, oh my gosh, like this thing that my dad worked on is in this book that's at school. That's,
yeah,
you know, crazy.
That is crazy. So your dad was very influential in your life, especially with regards to this piece that you wrote about grids. So this also spoke to me as a fan of grid paper, graphing paper. And this particular bit that you say at the beginning really resonated with me. The emptiness of a totally blank page intimidated me by demanding that I make the first move. But graph paper invited my participation by steering my pencil in the grooves of its strictly regular lines. The grid was like a friend who had already done half the work for me. And I feel this exact same way, but I never really thought about it in those terms of like, why do I like graphing paper? Or why do I hate blank pieces of paper or an empty white canvas that is a browser viewport before you've actually put some HTML onto it. And it's like, there's just, you could put anything anywhere. But so it's like ultimate paradox of choice, right? But with graphing paper, with grid paper, kind of just like, hey, it's like approachable. Here's a starting place right here at this, you know, where these two lines cross. That's pretty poignant.
Thank you. Yeah. I think it's something that like I have thought about over the years, like my love for graph paper. And it's something that a lot of other folks, you know, it resonates with them when you talk about it, like, isn't graph paper so fun? Yeah, it is. But there's never, I think we just take it for granted that it's just this tool that exists in our world. And you use grids for everything and you use graph paper for all sorts of stuff. And we never really think about like where it comes from or, you know, why we're using it. And so the essay is kind of an attempt to talk about that stuff, but definitely with like a personal framing, because the first thing I asked myself was like, okay, when was the first time that I actually encountered a grid? Like, what is my first memory of that? And that kind of became like the starting point for the essay. And then I go on to explore kind of like different ways that grids have influenced the world and computation and user interface design and such.
Amelia, you are quite artistic, I will just say, at least very good at design. And I'm not sure if you consider yourself artistic in the sense of like drawing and stuff, but probably you can speak to that. I think you are. Do you like a blank page? Do you prefer a grid? What are your feels on this subject?
Oh, I love this. Sorry, it's just scrolling up and down this piece.
I know.
There's so many good visuals. I hate blank pages. I like grid paper. I also like recycled newspaper sketchbooks because, not that there's a grid, but it doesn't look like a pristine blank page.
I see.
You know, it's like you can mess it up and it's not going from like 100% new to completely destroyed. So there's right. It's less intimidating. But I like this concept of constraints are super helpful when you want to be creative.
Love that. Yeah. Constraints are everything, I think.
I'm curious, is there something specific about a grid, or would like a triangle or like a square grid, would a triangle grid be just as Ooh. Interesting.
Oh, that's such a good question. I thought about that when I was writing this essay, because there's, you know, yeah, you can think of it like lots of different shapes that can tile the plane, you know, regularly like that. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there is something special about a square grid, because for whatever reason, the space that we live in has, you know, this dimensionality to it. It's a three-dimensional space, and the axes of that space are orthogonal to each other. And the two-dimensional grid kind of goes with the grain of that orthogonality, right? The axes are like perpendicular to each other on a two-dimensional grid. So I'm sure somebody who is better at math and physics and understands this stuff, you know, could say it more poetically, but like, that's always kind of been my impression, is like the square grid just describes the world a little bit better. It just fits into your brain a little bit better for whatever reason.
Oh, that's interesting. I have enough psych and neuro background to know that there's something about
something to it.
There's some brain cells that specifically encode like horizontal lines and also vertical lines. And there are more of them than ones that go the other directions. But yeah, I'm completely out of my depth when I talk about it more.
I think that you've breached far enough that I think we can all have a takeaway at least. And I'm not going to go any deeper than that. In this piece, Alex, you talk about how, especially now we talk about computers, right? So the 2D world that has been the interface into our computers, right? The monitor, which is very much just an XY axis, a grid, if you will, is behind everything. And you go into some of the details of like early design of user interfaces, the Macintosh and stuff. And the one thing you also say is that if you want to know how something is made, you should look for the grids. They are the ever-present behind-the-scenes structure of our cities, our machines, our homes, and our lives. Our maps, right? As you start off talking about mapping, our games that we play, our computers. They're just like our charts that we love to look at and see, are things going up or down or left or right? Our quadrants. Like, we are grid-focused humans, aren't we?
We are, yeah, definitely. And that sentence of the essay was actually kind of like, that was like the first thing that I wrote, right? In my first draft, like that was like my first initial idea. And it came from my partner showed me some art piece. The name of the artist is escaping me right now. Maybe it'll come to me. But she showed me this image of like this final art piece that this artist had produced, and then the plan for the art piece side by side. And so you could see like how the artist was designing the final piece. And in the plan for the piece, there was a grid visible. And I immediately, my first impression was like, I think that the plan looks cooler than the final piece. Like, like taking away that grid scaffolding actually kind of makes it less aesthetically, pleasing to me personally. And I find that a lot. Like, I love seeing the plan for the thing sometimes more than the thing itself. Like, it's really cool to see the plan for a design system as opposed to seeing like the design system implemented on some web page.
Yeah. I kind of have that going on right now at my house. So my oldest son is doing a pumpkin patch this year. He's going to try to sell some pumpkins. And so we went out and we tilled up a 50 by 100 yard space in our land. And he got out some graphing paper, and it was like, all right, we got to plan out this pumpkin patch. You put things, you know, you put each hill 8 feet apart. We need 80 hills. He has bought all these seeds, various kinds. And so he starts charting out, like, you know, each square is 4 feet or whatever it is. And he draws out the little deal. And then I point out to him, hey, if you put like A through F on the left-hand side, because it's like 6 rows, 12 columns, and 1 through 12 on the bottom, now it's like Battleship. You can basically just be like, okay, this kind of pumpkin starts at A12 and this one ends at B7 or whatever. And his eyes lit up with that. He's like, oh, it is like Battleship. Now it was fun. And the thing that we ended up drawing was really, really cool. And then we go out into the real world and we actually start to do it. And it's still cool, but it's not going to map directly onto that perfect grid anymore. It's going to be off by this much or that much. It's going to be, you know, there's a rock here, there's a hill that we misplaced, and like, and also the pumpkin patch is on a slope, and so it's like, it doesn't, you know, you have to account for the angle. Anyways, point being is I think I'm going to like the design on paper better than I'm going to like the actual patch that's analog.
Totally. Yeah. I love that you are passing on the grid to your son as well. That's
it was actually just circumstantially, I hadn't read the Battleship reference until after I told him about it. And I was like, I just used that because in your piece also you talk about Battleship and how we, you know, we see grids in our games and don't even realize it. And yeah, so that resonated as well with me. We should probably get a little bit into the other aspect of what you do is you're not just an artist or a writer, but you're also a programmer and you use software to make your art. And as Amelia referenced, as you scroll this piece, which of course is linked up in the show notes, you know, there's art involved with this essay and it's all grid-based art and it's all JavaScript driving things behind the scenes. So maybe give us a little bit of a background into your work that you do beyond just this. This is just one of your pieces. You've got a bunch of work, so much that I was like, I had to ask you, what do we talk about? Because you have so many pieces that we could talk about on the air. Give us a background into some of the art that you do, both in the real world and digitally, and like what drives you to make certain things.
Sure. So I actually started programming because I was interested in creating digital art. I came across this guy on the internet called Daniel Schiffman, who is an artist and programmer and teacher, and he has an amazing YouTube channel where he explains basically how to make art with code. And I found him in high school. So this was before he had a YouTube channel. I think he was teaching at NYU and he had put his course notes online so you could see them publicly. And I was just totally like transfixed by these course notes. I forget how I found them, but I was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. You can create these amazing images and interactive content using code. And I didn't really quite know what code was, but I was like, I want to learn this so bad. So that's actually kind of the first encounters I had with programming code was through a desire to create art. And then I went on to study computer science in college and kind of like that, you know, turned into a professional career as a programmer. But the art side of it has always stayed with me. So it's always something that I've pursued kind of on the side, right, after I come home from my day job. And I've done all sorts of art using code. I've created physical installations that are interactive. So if you've ever been to like an art gallery and seen something that's projected that you get to like play with, that sort of thing, I think it's called like media art is the term that folks use. I've also done visuals for musicians and for bands and little music videos. And then I've also done kind of more web-based stuff. So like the Grid World piece that we were talking about is more of a piece that's web native, intended to be viewed on the web. So kind of a wide range of work. I work a lot with collaborators. So the Space Filler name is kind of, I think of it almost like a band where there's like different members of the band that join for certain gigs, right? And so I have my primary collaborator, Alex Nagy, who I work with on a lot of the physical installations. And then, yeah, just a slew of other folks who help out on various projects.
I think I missed this. Is this still kind of like your side work or has this taken over for full time what you do?
It kind of oscillates back and forth. So, but I would say like there have been periods when it has been like my full time thing, but in general, it's a side project.
Hello, friends. This is Jared here to tell you about Changelog++. Over the years, many of our most diehard listeners have asked us for ways they can support our work here at Changelog. We didn't have an answer for them for a long time, but finally, we created Changelog++, a membership you can join to directly support our work. As a thank you, we save you some time with an ad-free feed, sprinkle in bonuses like extended episodes, and give you first access to the new stuff we dream up. Learn all about it at changelog.com/++. You'll also find the link in your chapter data and show notes. Once again, that's changelog.com/++. Check it out. We'd love to have you with us. So this Grid World piece that we brought up already is interesting technically to focus in on because one of the things you mentioned about it is how you eschewed the use of frameworks. And before the show, Amelia's like, this is where I get shamed and I use so much JavaScript and Alex is not going to. And you kind of just went vanilla JS from scratch to build all of the tooling you need in order to animate these grids. It's probably difficult for the listener to know exactly what we're talking about if they haven't scrolled the site, but interspersed amongst the pros are these grid animations, which are basically attached somewhere to your scroll. And so as you scroll them into the frame, you know, they're going to animate. They're like kind of grids of grids. Everything's kind of a pixel square at the atomic level of this piece. And then they move. One's even called Battleship, I believe, if you look inside at the DOM. So you built that and you didn't use, I don't know, I would just like, I don't know, Amelia, what would you grab? You're like, okay, I'm going to build something like, because you do really cool animations as well, and especially on your blog.
Oh, yeah. I go to NPM. I download every single package. Throw them all in there.
Right. But it works, right, Amelia? I mean, you put out some really cool stuff.
Makes my life easy.
Right. So, Alex, why didn't you just go out to NPM and just download the Grid World package and be done with it all?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about this because this is something that I think is really interesting. And so I just want to back up a little bit and describe that this Grid World piece that I made was for a publication that my partner Shelby Wilson and my friend Max Neely Cohen run called the HTML Review. And it's like a web-based literary journal.
Super cool, by the way. You can tell your partner, just super cool. I love this whole concept. I love the execution.
Yeah, it's
so just adding a little props in there. Go ahead, continue.
It's awesome. I mean, and so much of like my work kind of comes from conversations with her. And I actually have like major imposter syndrome being on this podcast because she's like a proper front end web dev, and I am constantly having to ask her questions about.
Like, oh, we should have invited both of you. Had I known that this was a dynamic duo, we would have had two guests on the show. But
you should have her on separately, but. You know, you described how the piece like reacts to scrolling.
Right.
And I definitely had to ask her, like, how do I get the scroll position correctly? Because I was having trouble with that. So she runs this, or she helps run this thing called the HTML Review. The entire ethos of the HTML Review is getting back to the basics of the web, like getting back to the primitive building blocks. What can we do with HTML and CSS and maybe just like a little bit of JavaScript or maybe not any JavaScript at all? And so that's been like a really inspiring thing for me because I think all professional programmers can relate to just kind of like, I don't know, NPM exhaustion, where you're constantly just like downloading libraries and frameworks and reading through documentation. And it can just get a little bit like boring, or it can kind of feel like you're detached from the process a little bit. Now, obviously, those frameworks are incredibly useful. And in my professional work, I'm definitely downloading, you know, all the dependencies from NPM. But for this piece, like because it was for the HTML review, where the whole point is to kind of like see what we can do with the old web, like how can we make these web technologies more personal, more intimate? I decided, okay, I'm just going to not use any dependencies. I'm not going to have any libraries. I'm not going to use any graphics rendering engines. I'm just going to use like the basic browser API to do everything. And that ended up being like quite a challenge because there's a lot of things that these libraries offer you that you take for granted. For example, drawing lines. It turns out drawing lines is really hard. And there is a primitive mechanism for drawing lines, you know, using the Canvas API, but I really wanted to use WebGL because I wanted to do stuff with shaders. And so if you're using raw WebGL, drawing lines that have a thickness is not something that you get out of the box. That's something that your graphics engine would provide to you. And so I had to, you know, read up on algorithms for drawing lines. Luckily, there's this amazing tutorial by, I won't pronounce his name right, but I think it's Matt Deloriers, who has this tutorial called Drawing Lines is Hard, where he goes through like the trade-offs of all these different ways of drawing lines. So that's just an example of like, yeah, one of the things that I had to build to create this interactive essay without using any dependencies.
I think one, I mean, I joke, right? Sometimes I throw everything at it, but I really am kind of a purist. Like, I think you should, as much as possible and practical, do everything yourself on the web. I also think most web developers should do at least one project from scratch, because the field gets a lot into like, oh, do you know React? Do you know Vue? Do you know Svelte? And it's like, I'm a good web developer because I know React and I can get all these jobs. And I think there's not enough appreciation for what the frameworks are doing. And then people run into all these bugs because they don't really understand the underlying technology. So I really appreciate that message. I'm also curious, like, are you usually using WebGL or Canvas, or like what tools are you reusing over and over again for your projects?
I have done a couple of projects using WebGL. So for this, for the graphics for this essay, I was building on like prior work that I had done. For example, the line drawing algorithm was something that I had already investigated for a different project. And I have like a little a particle system, like a physics, very, very basic physics simulation framework that I had created as well that I built on top of. So I do have kind of like a set of like personal, very, very small, humble personal libraries that I used. And because I have like complete control and knowledge of the code there, I can like rip things out to decrease the file size. I had this like obsession with this project of trying to make the file size as small as possible. So yeah, it definitely is building on prior work. And then for some of my other like installation-based work, I'm using graphics. I'm using shaders, for example, so I have some experience there. So it wasn't like starting completely from scratch in terms of the graphic side of things, but it definitely like pushed my ability a little bit to like have this constraint. We talked about constraints earlier in terms of like the constraints of the grid, and I think constraints are always where the coolest stuff comes from, because like for this essay, giving myself that limitation of not having any, you know, not depending on any external libraries, it really informed what I could do, because I couldn't do some of the ideas that I had because I didn't know how to implement them. And so that forced me to kind of be like, okay, well, what can I do with the tools that I do have?
What was harder, you think, or more time consuming, the prose for the essay or the code for the grid world?
Oh, definitely the prose for the essay.
Okay.
Yeah. That was like pulling teeth for me. I find it very difficult to write, whereas the kind of the purely technical challenges in the code are that just, I feel like I have a lot more energy for that, or it's just like a simpler, it's a more well-defined problem. And then the kind of the creative visual aspect of it, I find really enjoyable as well. Kind of like that feedback loop of making a tweak and seeing what it looks like. To me, I find that certainly easier than writing. I know I don't understand how some people can write so quickly and so well.
I really can't either. We had Cory Doctorow on the Changelog a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about how he writes so prolifically. I mean, the guy has 7 books in the works right now, and they're all going to publish at some point. And he also blogs daily, and he writes deeply daily. And I was just like, I had to ask him, how do you do? Because for me, writing something of significance, you know, sure, I can write out a quick thing here or there, I can communicate. But writing anything of significance feels like such an undertaking that I avoid it, because I just know how painful the process is going to be. And yes, it's usually worth it at the end and all those things, but that doesn't help me get started anyways, you know, because I know how much it hurts to like bring forth a thought in a final form. And I agree that coding feels so much easier to start because it's iterative. There's like little wins along the way, I guess you can say, with writing, like, oh, I love this paragraph, but I don't tend to love any of the things that I put out. Whereas maybe this function I wrote, I do kind of appreciate how it turned out, you know? And so I wonder what it is about that. It's all writing at the end of the day, but it's like different types of writing have different difficulty levels. Amelia, you're nodding along. Do you agree?
I hate writing. So I wrote a book on a JavaScript framework, and the only way I could do it is you start by writing the code, right? Like, okay, every chapter is going to have a focus. For this chapter, we're going to write this code snippet. And then you go through the code, you write it, and then you're like, how did I know what to write? And then you just go through the process. But like anything creative, anything not linked to code, it's very, very painful. And I wonder if it's a matter of like how many hours we already have in it, right? Like for drawing, people who aren't good at drawing hate it. And they're like, oh, I'm not an artist, right? I can't draw. But
right.
The people who are artists have just drawn enough that they like what they're seeing. And I think we all went through this with coding, or maybe this is not true.
No, there's something to that. I think it was, who's the guy who does This American Life, the producer of This American Life and The Voice? I can't think of his name right now. Blanking on his name. Both of you are blanking as well.
I think I know what you're about to say, though.
Anyways, he talks about the talent and style gap. I'm also getting that wrong.
Yes.
But it's basically like this gap between your taste,
Ira Glass.
Okay, we're all onto this now.
We got there
eventually. Yeah, and his premise, which I think all of us have agreed with, which is why we're all like, yes, we know about this, is that like when you start a thing, your taste is in one place. Like you know what's good or what you like, but your skill is so far, the gap between the skill to bring that taste out and the taste is so far away that you just despise whatever it is that you're doing. But, you know, like you said, Amelia, it's just the hours in between. Like it's the toil that brings your skills up to a point where they can come to the point of maybe being close to your actual taste. We all tend to still discount, I think, our own creations. But overcoming that gap is like just very difficult. And so, yeah, so like I'm a guy who doesn't draw. I never really put the time in. I'm okay with that. Like we all have to have certain things that we do. And it wasn't something that really I had much joy out of as a young person, but I just consider myself a guy who can't draw. And I know that if I put in, you know, the requisite 10,000 hours that, you know, Malcolm Gladwell says everybody has to put in to be an expert, I could be a drawer. Like I could be a person who draws. I haven't crossed the gap and I just don't. We only have so many things that we can pick to like, I'm going to put the time in because we don't have so much time. But I feel like I've written a lot in my life and I still despise it.
I my opinion is that, and this is completely like unfounded, but I think that writing is just harder than other tasks. I think good writing is really good thinking and there's no way to like cheat that. Right? Like there's no shortcut to it really. Like you can use flowery language to make something sound nice and pretty, but when it comes down to it, like you have to have thought through, you know, your chain of thought. And to me, that's the painful part is like, right. Oh crap, I actually have to think through what I'm saying.
That's so interesting because you can say the same thing about coding, but you don't publish your code. So you could have like really like nasty looking code. Yeah, that does the correct thing, but it's not good code.
So that's sort of true. And I agree with it, but I was looking at Alex's code. It was just the bundled version, of course. And so he has to ship his code to a certain extent, but it's all minified and bundled. And so I use the tools to at least pretty print it, but all the variable names are changed. And you know, it's not the original thing that Alex wrote.
No, that actually is the original.
That is the thing that you wrote. I was like, dang, dude, you are good.
Next level.
All these one letter variable names. I'm not sure how you do it. And so you can kind of hide. I mean, in binary world is 100% true. Like I compile my code, I ship a binary, right? In web world, it has been, and in many cases, it still is that you do ship your code into the browser and it's at least observable by the end user to an extent, right? But a lot of us do ship our code as in the form of open source. And I was actually looking at your code, Alex, and thinking it would have been cool if there was like a raw version of this. It's like, here's what I actually wrote, because maybe I don't want to learn how to draw lines in WebGL. And 12 kilobytes is pretty small. You know, maybe I could be okay with maybe ripping a part of your thing out and using it for my own thing. Did you consider putting the code out there, or maybe it exists somewhere?
Yeah, this is funny because this is exactly what my partner Shelby asked me. Like, why are you going to minify your code? That's not in the ethos of the HTML review, right?
Right.
It's all about like view source and sharing knowledge. And I do agree with that. I think in this case, like I've put so much work into these like personal little libraries that I've created that it's kind of like, it's almost as much a part of my artistic style as my like aesthetic sensibility, this like technical, you know, aspect of it. And so I just made the decision that for at least for this piece, like I'm not ready to publish it open source. I do have open source code on my GitHub. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I'm really interested in all of my projects are creating these like simulated ecosystems, these like lo-fi plants and creatures that swim around. And that's something that I used a little bit for the Grid World essay. But all of that, all of those algorithms are open source on my GitHub. Now, they're completely unusable because of how crappy the code is, because when I'm writing code for art, it's like my brain switches into this other mode where I'm just like, no comments, no organization, just like vomiting it out, right?
Means to an end.
Yeah, but if you want to try to pick it apart, like it's there. And then maybe in the future, I would consider like cleaning up parts of my code and publishing it. It's just like, that's almost like a whole other project to like clean it up to the point where somebody could use it and understand it and learn about it without getting frustrated.
I had actually seen these art pieces before around the web. And one, I'm obsessed with them. They're super cool. Like they have like collision detection and they feel alive in a really interesting way because they're very like pixelated, I guess is the word. Like they're low res intentionally. I'm curious if you have any like specific inspirations, because I feel like they're pretty unique, right? I haven't seen anything like them.
Thank you so much. The low res thing is interesting because I kind of fell into that. So the story is that I was commissioned to create a permanent installation here in Seattle, where I'm based, as part of like an apartment building that was being constructed. And so this was like a huge break for me because the art thing is, you know, mostly a side project. So to be commissioned to do like, you know, quote unquote, a real art installation was a big deal. So I worked a lot on this proposal for them where I proposed to create this virtual ecosystem on these big bright screens on the side of this apartment building. And the developer was really excited, you know, signed the contract. And then when I started working on it, I ran into a ton of technical hurdles because I hadn't ever really done anything like that before. And so when I actually like hooked up the computer for the installation and ran my code to simulate this virtual ecosystem, I found that it just wasn't performing very well because the virtual ecosystem is based on a particle simulation where each particle has to compute its distance to all of its neighboring particles to implement collision detection so that the particles can have forces applied so that they don't overlap. And there's a lot of optimizations you can do, but when it comes down to it, this is like an n squared thing. You know, you're comparing every particle against every other particle. And so I just couldn't fill this space with enough particles to fill up the screen because the algorithm was too slow. And so I was like, what do I do? And then I was like, well, if I just have the size of the simulation and use, you know, 50% of the particles and then scale the graphics up to fill the screen, then it can run well. And that's where I hit upon like that low res look, because when I was scaling up the graphics, I decided to try, hey, let's not do any smooth interpolation when I scale up the graphics. Let's just do kind of like hard pixelated interpolation. And it looked really, really cool. And so then that kind of like became a style that I've used, you know, throughout all of my work. But really, I fell into it because of technical limitations and constraints. It's like the thing about constraints leading to creativity.
Our good friend.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that story.
I will say, though, that I, you know, as I've like done more pieces using that low res look, I've become attached to it because I really like how it focuses your eye on kind of like the underlying behavior, the underlying algorithm. It's like the code or the algorithm is the subject of the piece a little bit more rather than some sort of photorealistic effect. So it's kind of like making the surface of the piece like more transparent, and you can like see through it into the computation that's happening. And that's the thing that I want to emphasize rather than trying to render a scene realistically or like use the latest and greatest special effects, if that makes sense.
That does. It's like there's less flashy stuff to look at. So like the less things there are, the more you're looking at the thing under the thing, right?
Exactly. Yep, exactly.
Do you think in pieces or in in installations? And I'm asking that from the perspective of a developer, because we tend to, I don't know, maybe like create toolkits or create libraries or create things that persist, or some of us work on the same thing for a really long time. I mean, at this point in my life, I have one software project that's like the main thing I do, right? Changelog.com, which powers everything that we do here at Changelog. And I've been coding on that thing for 8 years. I have other things that I work on, you know, like little side projects and these kind of that. But like, that's like a long-term thing where like when you make a choice, you're like, I'm going to have to live with this for years. I think some of the freedom that I would think comes with artistic pieces, like the ones that you create, is kind of the ability to start fresh every time, or to like let the past be the past. And I know that in the world of like data journalism, there's a lot of that going on where it's like, I create a piece for this report that we're doing. Rich Harris talked about this when he was creating Svelte, and the work he was doing at the New York Times was like, they had these one-offs, that each thing was a new project. And so it's a new opportunity to start fresh and try new things or build something that you reuse. How do you think about it, Alex? Do you kind of start fresh each time? The reason I'm asking is you have kind of this one aspect that has to be, it's kind of a theme now that's coming through multiple pieces. But how do you look at it?
It's hard for me to turn my engineering brain off totally when I'm working on art. And so obviously I'm thinking about like costs, you know, time costs, and like, if I'm going to start fresh, then that means I have to build up a whole new set of like primitives to create the art with. And so I've found that just practically speaking, like I end up reusing code. Now, when I'm in the kind of like professional programmer mode, I'm much more clean about that reuse. I'm packaging things up in nice ways. I'm, you know, have a nice clean Git history and stuff like that. And then when I'm in kind of more creative coding mode, I'm way more messy. I have repositories that are just like 100 branches, you know, and there's, oh my gosh, it's like a nightmare. I'm filled with dread whenever I have to like go back and remember what I was working on before. Mm. But there definitely is a lot of that reuse. And I'm always surprised at like how practical that can be in creative pursuits, because if you go back to material that you've created before, but you have like a new perspective on it. So, you know, sometimes I'll like use the code that I created 2 years ago, but I'll have this new idea on how to like remix it. You can get these like really fresh new things like that emerge from that. So now I say that, but I also have re-implemented the same styles across different technologies. And that's kind of like the opposite mode, where I'm like literally writing something from scratch to achieve, you know, the same look or the same behavior that I had on another platform. So it kind of goes both ways.
That resonates a lot with me. Jared, you brought up data journalism. And when I was at The Pudding, they do like these data-driven articles as a team, right? There's eight people. And it's always tricky finding the right balance of like, what primitives do you reuse across projects? But you can't have too strict of a template, because it makes you less creative. You know, you feel kind of constrained to this framework. So I like the way you talk about it, Alex, where, you know, it's figuring out what are the right pieces that you want to preserve. So you're saving time, but you're not constraining yourself too much.
Right. It's like the balance of constraint, right? Because on one side, like this piece with GridWorld and your knowledge of WebGL and your abilities or lack thereof, you know, and how much time you want to put into it, really helped produce the art. But sometimes you want the art to drive the technology, right? Or you want the story. In the case of reporting, you don't want to be tied to a framework if the story is calling for something else. You don't want to be like, well, but we use this and here it is. I used it last time. I'm going to use it this time. I'm going to use it the next time. But that is a constraint as well. And so like, when is the constraint exactly what you need to produce the better thing? And when is it actually holding you back? I don't know.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. I think about that all the time. I think the data journalism side of it is probably way tougher to deal with, because that truly is like a, you know, creative pursuit. Like you're trying to like reimagine how to visualize this data, and like you're trying to be novel and interesting. But then you also have all of these, like, the constraints are very stringent, right? You have to present things like correctly, and it has to work on all browsers, and it has to be like accessible and all of this stuff. So I have like a lot of respect for that sort of practice. That's, yeah, pretty cool.
Do you find yourself itching to grow at work, but you're not getting the support you need from your manager? Or maybe you're at a career transition and trying to figure out what you want and how to get it. Or you've got a great job, but could use an external perspective on some tricky cross-functional relationships. Hi, this is K-Ball from JS Party, and these are the exact types of problems I'm helping folks with in my new business. I think about it as pair programming for non-technical problems. If you're curious, you can learn more and sign up for a free exploratory session at kball.llc/coaching.
One thing I'm very curious about is for these projects, like when you think about data visualization or generative art, it ends up being this kind of symbiotic relationship. And a lot of the time you can't foresee what the outcome is because you don't have complete control over what it's going to look like. I'm curious, like, what's your process like and how true or how strong of an initial vision do you usually have when you set out on these projects?
I have found that the way I work best is to not have too much of a vision at the beginning. So I'd characterize two approaches as being like top down and bottom up, where the top down approach is you have like this large grand story that you're trying to tell. You come up with what you want it to look like, or you know what you want the experience to be. And then you follow up and say like, okay, what are the technical ways that I can implement this? And I think that this is how, you know, really great like filmmakers work, for example. I've found that for myself, that is just not the way that I enjoy working. And I think it took me a while to like give myself permission to be like, oh, I just like the bottom-up approach. I like to tinker. I like to start really small and build up. And I like the technology. I like to kind of like go with the grain of the technology and like let that lead me a little bit, and maybe a similar way to a painter really letting the paint kind of guide them, right? Like having a conversation with the material. That's just kind of the approach that I like to take. It's not always practical because sometimes if you're commissioned to do something, and I've had this experience before where, you know, you have somebody coming to you and saying, hey, I have a vision. Can you bring your art to this vision? And that's a real struggle for me. I've had a hard time doing that in the past. It can be good though. Like I think both modes are good, and it's good to like try both and switch back and forth. But I'm definitely a fan of like the bottom up tinker approach.
What is like the seed usually of your bottom up ideas? Is it like, oh, I wonder how this interaction would feel, and then you build it and then you riff on it? Or is it really just playing around?
It's usually an idea about like a very low level behavior of like one of my algorithmic plants or animals. So again, these are all just particle systems where you have all of these interactions between particles. And so sometimes I'll just kind of be daydreaming about like, oh, what if, you know, you had a structure that was like a ring of particles and it could grow by adding particles into the ring. You know, what would that look like? And then, you know, I program it. I see what it looks like. It usually ends up nothing like how I imagined it. But then you hit on something where you're like, oh, but, you know, this is kind of cool. And then it kind of just goes from there. So I think like when you're dealing with these dynamic systems that have lots of like feedback loops in them, there's kind of a space of all of the possible dynamic systems you can imagine. And there's little pockets of coolness in that space. And you're trying to like tweak the parameters to guide your, you know, your ship to find those like little pockets. And I think what I have found is that those pockets are more common than you think. So like if you just keep tweaking and keep adding and keep exploring, like you will hit one of those cool pockets, you know, and it's not like you can kind of get there through random chance a little bit. And I've actually thought like, maybe an AI could do this because it's not actually super directed or anything. I'm really just kind of like randomly playing around with these ideas and then, oh, hey, this looks cool.
I literally had a whole conversation in my head about, oh, I really want to ask if you think AI could help with this, but I don't want to be the one to bring up AI in this episode. Right. So.
Well, Alex, he broke it out. Well, I think do you mean generate the things and you look at them as the artist, or do you mean actually, because the, oh, hey, this looks cool, like that moment right there, I don't think AI is there. I think that's us. And so like that, there's a symbiosis there. But are you referring to Alex out of the loop? Or are you referring to Alex in the loop?
Yeah, definitely. If the artist is in the loop, like I think it's way more possible. And I mean, and that's something that like, that's not even a super sophisticated idea, right? To like generate the same piece of artwork with your parameters tweaked a bunch of different ways. I actually think that I'm not an expert in machine learning, but I think that there's this term grid search where you like tune your hyperparameters or whatever a bunch of different ways and then see like what the results are. And, you know, I do stuff like that all the time. I don't think that that's really like AI.
Yeah.
But I think that if you were to have an AI that could like model your aesthetic preferences, you know, and there's Alex out of the loop, like that would be definitely more interesting and maybe more scary.
Or even to like knock you out of a rut. You're like, oh, just come up with these oddball inspirations from, you know, things that I wouldn't necessarily think of. And you could look at one and be like, oh, huh, that's cool.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I do think that like for me, and I'm speaking as somebody whose livelihood does not depend on my art because it is like a side project. So it's definitely like coming from a different perspective. But for me, like even if AI could do what I can do, I wouldn't use the AI to do it necessarily because I just enjoy the process so much. Like creating art for me is about learning and understanding. It's not really necessarily even about the end goal. It's about that tinkering process. I just find that enjoyable and fun. And so if an AI could do that part, it would be not as fun for me. But I do think that there's like really interesting applications of AI for creatives. And so I think that like lots of people will start using these tools in interesting ways. It's just for this personal art practice.
Yeah.
I can't see myself really using it that much.
Well, Alex, there are many things that we could talk to you about, but in the spirit of this episode, we'll keep it constrained. We'll just focus it in on Grid World. Of course, listener, there are many more pieces of art. He even has a shop where each design is generated at the moment you order it, algorithmically generated goods. So definitely check the links. You can find Alex's work at alex.miller.garden. And of course, we will have links for you in the show notes. Alex, I'm serious about doing a show on the HTML review. Let's hook that up. Amelia, of course, you're welcome back. I just love cool indie, interesting web things. I feel like the web has gotten somewhat boring. So corporate, we're starting to see a backlash against that, like more small, independent, creative, web-based things. I love the idea of a web native, not newspaper, but I guess magazine. I don't know how it's...
Yeah, I think magazine is a good word.
Yeah, we'll ask her about the details on the HTML review on a future episode, but really appreciate you coming on the show. This has been a lot of fun. Amelia or Alex, any final thoughts or final words before we call it?
No, thank you so much for having me. It's really, like I said, I've got major imposter syndrome being on the show and, you know, not being a super great web dev myself. So it's humbling to be on here with you guys. But yeah, thanks so much.
Well, you are welcome here. Everybody is welcome here. There are no imposters. That's one of our mottos here at Changelog. We're all welcome. So this has been lots of fun. Amelia, it's always a pleasure. Oh, by the way, real quick, you wrote a thing, Amelia. You published this week about AI chatbots, right?
Oh, yeah, that was surprisingly controversial.
Give us 30 seconds. Give us the synopsis and then the controversy.
It all started with ChatGPT.
Sounds like a story.
I'm still shocked that it blew up the way it did, and so I have a lot of thoughts about why chatbots aren't it, and we're really leaning on them pretty heavily recently for
right.
AI interfaces. So,
okay, and we'll leave it at that. So there's a teaser for you. I'll link to that one in the show notes as well if you want to read Amelia's words, and then you'll probably have strong opinions about them. It seems like everybody else does, which is good. Conversation is a good thing. All right, let's end it right here. I'm Jared. This is JS Party, and we'll see you on the next one. episode of JS Party has a Changelog Plus Plus bonus, where Amelia laments the Hacker News response to her blog post about AI chatbots not being it. If you aren't a Changelog Plus Plus member, fix that bug at changelog.com/plus. Make the ads disappear. Get awesome bonuses, such as extended episodes like this one, and directly support our work here at Changelog. Check it out at changelog.com/plus. Special thanks once again to our partners Fastly and Fly for helping us bring you awesome pods each and every week. And to our Beat Freakin' residents, Breakmaster Cylinder. We love you, BMC. Next up on the pod, we're talking JavaScript ORMs. Yes, object relational mappers. Are they good? Are they bad? Are they ugly? Stay tuned right here. We'll have that episode ready for you next week.